But in terms of did it matter to Britain at the time, the period of slavery, as you know, coincides with the Industrial Revolution in Britain. Industrial Revolution, urbanization, Britain is the first major urban society in which people don't live on the land and farm for subsistence. They live in the towns, they make stuff, and they buy food from a commercialized agriculture. And because of this chronological overlap between slavery and the Industrial Revolution, the question, of course, arises, what is the connection, if any, between the two? And again, going back to my opening comments, this is a critically important political discussion about British national identity. Because, not today, but certainly when I was being taught, the Industrial Revolution was conceived as being the outgrowth of British technological genius, focused on the entrepreneurs and the inventors, and on social changes that took place over the long term in Britain, the commercialization of agriculture. So when you bring slavery onto the table, it can be a new element. And for you in the classroom, I think that you're caught between the Scylla and Charybdis of slavery brought about the Industrial Revolution, or the Industrial Revolution being taught with no reference to slavery whatsoever. And of course, but the truth is in between, and the question is locating it there. Nobody seriously argues that Britain's involvement in the slave economy caused the Industrial Revolution. That cannot be true because Britain was one of several European nations who were deeply engaged in the slave economy. The Dutch were at least as committed to it, the French were committed to it. None of those had an Industrial Revolution. So it's not a sufficient explanation for the Industrial Revolution. And as I say, nobody seriously argues that. Many people who want to negate the importance of slavery phrase it in those terms and say, we are defending British history against the charge that slavery caused the Industrial Revolution. That is a straw man that's been set up as part of this political discussion. As I say, nobody is arguing that. So in order to kind of navigate or help you navigate your way through the thickets here, what do people know about Eric Williams?
He's a legend.
He was a legend.
He was president in Trinidad after he wrote his book, right? Did he become prime minister or president?
He was the first
prime minister. I've been told he's only tiny.
He flips the whole argument on the head and he says it's not humanitarian, it's not the state's argument, it's economic arguments as to why the abolition of slavery happened.
Took him ages to get from his PhD because he's black.
Everybody set?
My teacher's great granddaughter.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So I speak under Tabo's control. But Williams was, as was identified correctly, the first Prime Minister of independent Trinidad and Tobago, and in fact died in office, a long period in which, amongst other things, he used the consequences of the oil shock to try to industrialize Trinidad and to use its oil resources to develop an economy that wasn't simply a colonial dependent economy, but was an autonomous economy. So a very important figure, obviously, in Caribbean history. But in 1944, he published a version of his PhD thesis under the title of Capitalism and Slavery. There was quite a lot going on in the world in 1944, and it was really in the 1960s, as part of the establishment of an independent Caribbean historiography, as the colonial, the former colonial possessions in the Caribbean became independent nation states, that capitalism and slavery came back on the table. And Williams's arguments, or that book as a whole, makes all the historiographical discussion that's happened in the last 80 years since his work a series of footnotes. That's really what's happening. Because he frames all the questions that now historians continue to scramble to answer. It's a seminal text. It's 190 pages of very, very dense, elusive, easy to read, incantatory prose. He can carry you forward until you're at a point where you haven't fully recognized what he's doing, and suddenly you're at the end of his argument without noticing the evidence along the way. It's an incredible book, and it does frame everything that we're going to talk about now, including many of the things that are outside the economics. As I think Charlotte was saying, he had important arguments to make about abolition, but for our purposes now, I'm going to focus primarily on what he had to say about slavery rather than abolition. So, as you can see, he characterized his book, this is from the preface, he called it strictly an economic study of the role of Negro slavery and the slave trade in providing the capital which financed the industrial revolution in England, and of mature industrial capitalism in destroying the slave system. So in that one sentence, you have effectively a key thesis, which is that slavery builds up industrial capitalism, and then industrial capitalism destroys slavery. And we can talk separately about what the component parts of that argument are, but that's the turn, the dialectical turn he makes in his argument. So all the way through his book is threaded that that strong theme as to what is happening. And he sees a movement from what he calls mercantilism, commercial capitalism, to industrial capitalism. Slavery is part and parcel of that commercial capital system. And then when Britain industrializes, slavery becomes not only superfluous, but actually obstructive. And therefore, he says abolition is able to take place. He doesn't say that that causes abolition. Again, you have to read him very carefully. What he says is that the capitalists abandon slavery. The abolitionists have been working anyway, and he says the critical movement is when the abolitionists seduce the industrial capitalist into an alliance against slavery, and then slavery is struck down. So very, very sinuous, important arguments. And then he talks at various points in the book about the importance of slavery to the Industrial Revolution. And he talks of the triangular trade, which is the word he uses, and also, as you will notice, 1944, he himself is using the word Negro. So again, you'll deal with that in the classroom as you need to. So he's talking about their classic triangular trade. So the purchase of British manufacturers, then they're exchanged, brought back to Britain, and the export market, the maintenance of the Negroes and their owners provide another market for British industry. Then the profits from the triangular trade supplied part of a huge outlay for the construction of the vast plants to meet the needs and the new production processes. This is one of the more controversial components of his argument, because the argument is made that actually Britain didn't need much investment, that the Industrial Revolution was a relatively slow process, there was plenty of capital in Britain, we didn't need the capital from slavery. What the work of LBS, amongst others, suggests is that it doesn't matter whether that was true or not. We can demonstrate that money from slavery did, in fact, finance significant portions of some parts of the Industrial Revolution. So the fact that there could have been other capital is neither here nor there. We can actually show the money flow from slavery. So, and then critically, again, for you, I think, the last comment he makes, it must not be inferred that the triangular trade was solely and entirely responsible for the economic development. The growth of the internal market in England, the ploughing of the profits from industry generates support. Played a large part. Okay, and again, if you're teaching Williams, or teaching Williams and his critics, or teaching this issue about the importance of slavery, those two sentences are absolutely central. Because he's signaling here that, of course, he understands and knows that the Industrial Revolution in Britain comes out of long-term changes in Britain, in which slavery then forms, in his view, a catalytic role. And it's the combination of those things that produced the Industrial Revolution. So that's his stated position. It's often caricatured to say that he argued that slavery caused the Industrial Revolution, or that the profits of the slave trade financed the Industrial Revolution. And there's enough in his text to see why people can infer that, but that's not what he in fact was arguing. So Williams is a key kind of thesis, and probably still the best way of organizing this discussion because of the clarity and importance of his thoughts. And then there's the critics of Williams. See, Eltham Ingerman, this article from 2000, representing a completely different trajectory of thought, and as you can see explicitly here, the slavery business formed a relatively small share of the Atlantic trade when the European power. Its direct contribution to the economic growth of any nation was trivial. So that's the other part, that's the other end of the spectrum, which says that actually slavery was irrelevant to Britain. Britain would have industrialized at the same rate and pace even without involvement in the slave system. And that is a very important part of mainstream economic writing and thinking still in Britain. As you can see in the last, I think, hope you can see in the last quotation from there, it conflates different arguments and again caricatures what is actually at stake. Slavery did not by itself cause the British Industrial Revolution. Okay? That conclusion is shared by everybody, including Robert Williams. It certainly helped that revolution along. So they're acknowledging that there is a role, but its role was no greater than that of many other economic activities. And then they go on to say, well, if we assume away the activity, we would have industrialized in the same way. That counterfactual is not provable, as you will understand. No counterfactual is. And what they're actually doing is recognizing the force of the argument that this is a major economic activity. But that's not effectively how their own argument is then being pitched. They're arguing for the trivial importance of it, and then, in effect, undercutting themselves. So the tensions that run through that article are worth, again, with your older students at least thinking through. And then there's a more considered position. Okay? And there's a temptation to see Williams as the thesis,
yeah.
Elters and Engelmann as the antithesis, and then something else, Barbara Solow. But as I say, what effectively is happening is that Solow is going back to Williams and saying, guess what? This is still valid. So slavery made more profits from investment, larger national income for the empire, and the pattern of trade which strengthened the comparative advantage of the home country in industrial commodities. So as I said, you have to navigate in your classrooms around those false binary of it's all or it's nothing. Okay? Nobody argues it's all, or at least very few people argue that it's all. Some very important influential historians argue that it's nothing. And then you need to work through what is the argument that's being made, how internally consistent it is, how coherent it is, and is it consistent with evidence?
What, just as like someone who's just finished teaching OCRA interpretations, if anyone else is doing that, on like Cold War and appeasement, what's the context of Eltis and Engelmann and their writing? Are they kind of like, are they economists? What kind of economists would you describe them as? Are they, I presume, Western, like in global North terms? Are they white? Like these kind of things, I guess, would be interesting as a history teacher to think about when you think about situating where these interpretations are contextually from.
Yep. One American and one English historian, one British historian, Peltis is a Brit, although he teaches in the States. White historians, and coming out of a tradition in the US of econometric history, the kind of remodeling, the large scale stuff when computers first arrived. And so this is a relatively elderly generation. Eltis and Engelmann are going to die shortly. So,
is it the same Engelmann as Fogel and Engelmann?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In which case there is a huge literature on the historiography of Engelmann.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, David Eltis has been instrumental in building the transatlantic slave trade database, which is the most fantastic resource that is available to everybody. It's a major, major contribution. And it seems to me a paradox that Eltis, who spent his life researching slavery and working on it, is willing to say, as he says publicly, slavery made no difference to the development of the Western world. Okay. But David, if that's true, why would you spend your life researching it? And I mean, that's his dilemma. But his explicit position is that slavery didn't matter, didn't count. Can that be true? So, I mean, if you're asking Nathaniel about motivations, I can't tell you.
No, of course.
Okay, but there is, in the end, an undercurrent here, without a doubt, that is raced, if I can put it that way. There is a accepted form of classical economics that says, okay, so the slave trade generated profits that were equal to 1% of British national income, QED. We don't have to talk about this anymore. And that debate about small numbers is an important part of this. So if you're trying to measure economic significance, the one way you can guarantee that you will minimize the importance of something is saying, well, let's take the whole economy and then we'll take the size of this subsector and compare one to the other. If you have an economy in which, even in the 18th century in Britain, most of the economy was subsistence agriculture, then anything is going to look small next to it. Okay. And in this article in which they're arguing that it was had no importance, that appears to be a trivial importance, they're also acknowledging that actually it represents a percentage of the economy that is higher than the coal industry, for example, in this country. Okay. So that big number and small number loses the dynamics of an economy. And a historian called Joseph Inikori in the early 2000s published a very significant book called Africans in the Industrial Revolution, that didn't pass unnoticed but hasn't been incorporated into mainstream British economic historiography in the way that one might have expected. It's, again, a very, very powerful re-expression of William's, not at the macroeconomic level, but saying, okay, let's get into the insurance business, as Kate said. And he's saying, how much of the insurance business is slave-related? Okay, let's do the work. And you can debate his conclusions. He says 2/3. I've looked at the numbers. I think it's 40%. But, I mean, we're not talking here about 1% or 2%. We're talking about big chunks. And he argues that the slave trade and its focus on Liverpool is critically important in understanding the development of industrialization in the Northwest as opposed to in East Anglia, for example. So Inacora's book is an important contribution, not really picked up in mainstream historiography. It was very disappointing. 4 or 5 years ago, the Cambridge published a new Modern Economic History of Britain. These are big, authoritative books, edited by a group of very good economic historians. And then one chapter in that book by Muhala Zahedir is about overseas trade. And we're back into a mode in which people are concerned about population growth, commercialization of agriculture. These are all important things. These are all important things. But then to put trade, in overseas trade as a whole, of which slavery is only one part, of course, into a single chapter at the end of the book, treats it as though it's not relevant. And that tension about the role of overseas slave in trade and industrialization, in the end, is intellectually at the heart of this. I've portrayed this as though the critics of Williams are intellectually dishonest. I think that in some respects, some of them are at some points. But the basic debate is about what is the role of overseas trade in industrialization. And that's a good faith debate that people can have. But as I say, the presentation is less good. Yeah.
Sorry, I keep asking questions.
Sorry.
As a layman, would you say there's like one or two really good stats that even a year eight could get around to conceptualize the size of this within Industrial Revolution? I mean, maybe there isn't. I'm probably asking the wrong person because you don't want to do that. But is there like a year eight stat that you would say it was that big for the British Industrial Revolution?
I think that the single statistic is the most dangerous thing to do, because then you get into, okay, if it's 10%, that means that 90% of it was nothing to do with it. So I would absolutely steer away. What I think is a better approach is to say, let's think about individual fields and measure it there. And then I think Inacora's work on marine insurance seems to me to be perfectly relevant to say, okay, we're talking about a chunk of the financial sector, and then within that, Inacora says, 2/3 of this is slave-related in the 18th century. That's a significant number.
Or individual stories, I guess, as well.
So, somebody who's worth 250,000.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is, the one on the tax on colonial commodities coming in and how much the British West Indies pays that percentage of colonial tax.
Yeah, about 7 million of the national of the government's tax expenditure of 50 million. Is from sugar, indigo, West Indian produce. So again, you can argue that 15% of the state budget is financed by taxes from the West Indies. Our own work has shown that 15 to 20% of the richest people dying in the 19th century drew their wealth from slavery, either from slave ownership or from cotton or from adjacent industries. So again, those are different numbers, 15 to 20, Inacora is 2/3. But it moves away from saying, well, it's 3% of the GDP or whatever number Elton Engelman came up with. So the approach of looking for the single figure, I think, is the most cul-de-sac-y of all the things. It's one of the measures, but I think then the contextualization that you have to do is so laborious that you might just well go straight to the individual subsectors. So, as I said, this issue about the Industrial Revolution and the role of slavery matters today because of the question, as I've raised a couple of times already, who made modern Britain? And Williams is implicit, objective, in capitalism and slavery was, amongst other things, to make that case, to say, we, the descendants of the enslaved people, have been sidelined from British history, from British politics. We need to reassert, and here I am reasserting, the central importance of this population for the manufacture of the metropolis as it was in 1944, still the largest empire in the world and still the most kind of colonial imperial of all nations. And that was his political project, was to demonstrate the importance of that enforced labor. Okay. Of course, it was involuntarily extracted, but he's saying it had real value to the formation of modern Britain. As I said, if that is true, then modern Britain, in some respects, belongs to a wider group of people than perhaps has been assumed. I'm going to close relatively briefly, and this is not a report you're going to absorb right now. But it's an interesting document, and again, possibly for the classroom, once you have the context for it.